Hey everyone, welcome to Office Hours with Cloud Posse, where we discuss the latest DevOps news, AWS announcements, and Terraform insights, all sourced from our SweetOps community, plus a live Q&A you can't find anywhere else. It's August 20th, 2025. I'm your host, Eric Osterman. Real quick, I'm the founder and CEO of Cloud Posse. Cloud Posse sells AWS reference architectures that get you production in just 2 weeks. So if you're curious to learn more about that, just go to cloudposse.com. So, how can you maximize today's session? Well, first off, our format's informal. You can engage as much as you'd like and ask questions. And if you're curious about any of our open source tools like Atmos, this is a great place to ask. For those on the recording, we host these calls live, so don't miss out. Just join us live by going to cloudposse.com/officehours. cloudposse.com/officehours. Just enter in your email and you'll get an invite. Not right away, actually, like within the first 24 hours or so. So I do have one ask. If you find any portion of today's office hours valuable, share it with your team. Just head over to youtube.com/cloudposse. Again, that's youtube.com/cloudposse, and we'll be posting a recording of this there in just a few hours. So let's get started with the discussion of this week's current events. First, I don't know. Maybe DEF CON was pretty mild this year or something. I did see a lot of complaints that it was just too crowded, and it has been getting more and more crowded when the times that I've gone. But I don't know, very few articles caught my attention in the news cycle. Maybe I should go direct to the source. One of them was this, though. They demonstrated on stage, or they demonstrated or walked through a attack where they were able to coerce Microsoft's Copilot Studio, which is like a commercial offering of Copilot that enterprises can use. You can link it up with your Salesforce and other systems, and they were able to coerce it to give it information they weren't supposed to see, like all the financial details of customers and things like that coming from the Salesforce CRM. This is just, these kinds of announcements, and I have like. Actually, it's not totally related, but I have some other related ones coming up as well. Are just becoming more and more common because the science of keeping this stuff secure hasn't caught up with the advancements of what you can do with AI. So Microsoft apparently fixed this promptly after being privately notified, and then following responsible disclosure, they came out with this, I guess, at DEF CON. Any further insights on this one? All right. Next one was just, I thought it was interesting, a summary for, maybe people less accustomed to using AI prompts and so forth, and how easily they can be polluted. And this talks about how, when you share a link to some document somewhere or some URL somewhere that can have instructions on there you're not even aware of. And that can affect everything else in your conversation because that gets added to the context. And the AI model doesn't put a different weight or different priority on that context that came from somewhere else. It doesn't know the intent of what polluted that context. This shows a practical example of how that your answers can just suddenly start coming off totally random based on how the context was polluted. This is, of course, why the trust me mode is so dangerous because it can get a wild idea that deleting the database or deleting your past 10 years of code or AWS infrastructure, whatever, is a good idea. So don't trust AI. Anyways, that's probably beating what's the expression? Beating a drum that everyone's heard a lot about too much lately. I stumbled across this repository, which I thought was notable for the reason that I had no idea how many system prompt leaks there have been. Like, you hear about system prompt leak here and there. Well, here's a whole archive of all the system prompts that have been leaked and collected now on GitHub. And it's so remarkable how, presumably like billion-dollar investments in products, or at least million-dollar investments in products, are ultimately boiled down to a really smart prompt that somebody's iterated on. And funny because it's so different from all forms of software development before, where you actually had imperative code describing how it should work, and sometimes, if you're lucky, some declarative ways of configuring it. Now it's just Is there a term for that? Like, so, you have imperative code, which is, exactly what you're doing. Declarative way is presenting it in a way that it's more intuitive. And then what would you call prompts? Prompt code? I guess that's best I can do. All right. Next announcement. So we talked about Kiro. What was it? About a month ago or so, it was announced. And this is Amazon's own fork of VS Code, implementing agentic programming vis-a-vis like things like Cursor or Windsurf that you've heard about. And Kiro pricing for it wasn't available when it came out. And you couldn't even pay any amount to get more credits. You were kind of limited. So I'd heard really good things from Matt Calhoun on our team, who mentioned very positive feedback in his experiments using Kiro. What he liked about it was how it came up with the plan, came up with the task list of things it was going to do before executing it. And it was just very clear what was going on through the process. But the problem was you'd burn through the available credits too quickly. Well, the announcement here is on the pricing. And I don't know if you guys have seen the other talk on how much money companies like Cursor, I believe, are losing on their solutions. I forget the number. Don't quote me on this number. It was something like they make 10 cents for every dollar they spend or something crazy like that. So this is Amazon being Amazon, and they never make 10 cents on every dollar they spend. It's quite the opposite for Amazon, and I think that's what this pricing probably is telling us, that this is what they figured out. That said, we've all been accustomed to spending a whole lot less. When one of the people they interviewed here were saying they would expect to be spending about $500 a month for part-time use, and about $1,950 per month for full-time use, based on the number of interactions he would expect to have. And that to me makes sense. 1,000 interactions, 3,000 interactions, that's not that much, it would be my guess. Now, I haven't looked at my stats in Cursor or anything lately, but I bet I go through that pretty quick. Anyone kick the tires on Cairo or Kiro and have some input?
I don't know if you can hear me if I'm coming through, but I did try to get on Kiro. I got stuck on the wait list. And then when I saw the pricing, I bailed immediately because I use it too much to be spending 1200, 1500 bucks a month. Or when I say it, I use Cursor too much. I'm paying 20 bucks a month for Cursor. Give me great results. I'm not gonna leave my agentic IDE for like a spec-driven IDE, which sounds really, really cool. And I think, it'd be very applicable to the work that I'm doing, but I'm not willing to spend 1500 bucks to 2K a month to get that sort of benefit from my IDE.
Yeah, and I saw somebody. This is well, I don't want to break the train of thought, but I saw some workflows that seemed like they could apply to Cursor and trying to achieve similar outcomes. I wonder if this is has, does anybody know if this is something that might be coming to Cursor more formally? Then next announcement would be so this one hit close to home. This I don't know if this was came out during DEF CON or not. I didn't see any. Oh, it came out during Black Hat, which usually coincides with DEF CON, so that's why now. So back in January, researchers discovered a pretty awful attack vector on CodeRabbit. If you're not familiar with CodeRabbit is, they're one of the best AI-driven automated PR code review tools out there. It's free for open source projects, and what sets it apart from some of the other ones is that they run a lot of tools to try and get other data out of your pull request to determine to identify best practices, possible bugs, possible misconfigurations, and then explains it in a very clear way and provides even AI prompt instructions that you can copy and paste back into your editor to have it fix the recommendations for you and so forth. We've been running it at Cloud Posse, to be honest, for the past year or so, and it's really alleviated the burden on PR contributors for certain projects where we have it. So what these researchers discover was that one of those tools that it runs, in this case, is RuboCop, which is a one of the linting tools for Ruby projects. RuboCop supports a plugin system, if you will, and you could specify other Ruby scripts that it would run. Ordinarily, this wouldn't be too much of a concern. Like, let's say you were running RuboCop in your own repo with GitHub Actions. Pull requests already have a very secure context that they operate in with no secrets and no GitHub credentials other than those issued from your own identity or your own actor on GitHub. So it's safe in that way. You don't have access to repository secrets and so forth. But this is a problem with GitHub apps that are not properly designed with security in mind. And I bring this up more generally because I'm afraid that a lot of GitHub apps are implemented just the way that they did with CodeRabbit. So here's the issue. Or this is how the attack worked. So anybody who can open a pull request against a repository where CodeRabbit was installed could, in that pull request, add a malicious extension here. And here's an example that they have that would exfiltrate the context out of the machine, specifically all the environment variables. Well, the way CodeRabbit was working was they had a single process, or single processes. The idea is that they weren't, it'll make more sense. Let me continue my story. They had basically a process that had its app secret, app private key, app ID, all that required to do a token exchange with GitHub to get a token for that particular repository that they're working on. And when they were running the code associated with a pull request, they weren't running it in a secure context, just like I showed, was talking about GitHub Actions, how GitHub Actions normally works with no access to secrets and so forth. So, in that context that they were running the process, that process had access to their application secret and their application's ID, so they could exchange that for a token on any repository that GitHub app had been installed on. So the good news is that CodeRabbit fixed this problem quickly after being notified. It sounded like it was reported at the end of January this year, and it was fixed, I think, by the beginning of February. But there's a lot of there's a bad taste in people's mouths because that means that nobody found out about this until 6 months later. And that's an eternity when you're generating a lot of log events or storing those off in Glacier or from an audit perspective, or like your obligation to report this if you're a regulated company and you have CodeRabbit installed this is a was a potential vulnerability that you were subject to. So obviously these kinds of attacks are not that bad in the sense if you have branch protections protecting main, there's only so much they can do by gaining access to those credentials. But it also leaked private repository. It could have given you access to private repositories. That means intellectual property and so forth, which could have leaked from it. Anyways, I haven't read to see if there was any fallout for this or known attacks or are people exploiting this. It could be mentioned in the article, but thought it was an interesting read. Anybody have more thoughts on this one? Yeah, here's an example of what they were able to exfiltrate. Obviously, with values censored here. All right, next announcement. So yeah, CodeRabbit responded to that, but incidentally, the same day this was disclosed, and that's what people were not so happy about. Another interesting, totally unrelated topic was the external secrets project. So if you're using Kubernetes, chances are you're using external secrets. Like if you want to source your secrets from SSM, ASM, or any of like the plethora of backends supported by external secrets, this is the tool for you. It's really awesome. We use it too. I was really surprised to see this issue posted, which was first posted that, hey, heads up, we've decided to stop more releases until we get more maintainers on the team here. This is one of those, everyone's seen that meme kind of where, the whole internet depends on this one piece of software supported by one guy in Nebraska kind of situation. Well, turns out this call for help, this plea for help, worked. And a bunch of people have spoken up and offered their support for the project from a development perspective and so forth. So we'll see where that goes. This was open 3 weeks ago, and I forget when this was updated. So it ain't dead yet. All right, so you guys will probably remember that story about the 16 billion passwords that were leaked. Well, Troy Hunt confirms that, yeah, that was just trolling. And his thing or his argument is basically that in order to break into the news cycle, you need a bigger and even bigger and even bigger number of passwords that were leaked. And it turns out that this was really just a collection of a lot of past data leaks, and there was almost total overlap with what they already had in the database for Have I Been Pwned. So, the big to do, hoop to do about nothing. Also, I think that was the conclusion that a lot of other news agencies came to. So there was a attack against the GitHub Action, I don't know, 2 months ago, 3 months ago, time goes so fast, I don't know, 6 months ago. TJ Files affected, or TJ Actions was the organization, and the GitHub Action was like affected files or something like that. And this was a really scary incident that the GitHub Action was compromised. Somebody quickly detected it, but this is used in just all over the place in open source projects and probably private repositories as well. The sunshine, the good thing about this is if you were pinning to a SHA, you probably were not affected by this unless you happened to pin at that ex precise moment that they had the vulnerable commit in there. Well, one of the best practices for GitHub Actions has been for a while to pin to SHAs, and there are a lot of tools out there that help make that easier. I know there's one that we've used. I'll look it up. But what's nice about this update is GitHub now supports a security setting that you can enable to require actions to be pinned to a full-length commit SHA. So as an enterprise, that's probably not a bad idea to reduce the attack vector of supply chain attacks against GitHub Actions. Now, what's interesting is this combined with the cooldown period for Dependabot being the other project by GitHub that was acquired a long, long time ago, for automatically updating your GitHub Actions. And Dependabot supports commit SHA pinning. So in Dependabot, you can now have a cooldown. We talked about this last week. And this is a minimum age of a package. So again, security is all about the defense in depth, right? Lots of little things get you more secure. You never have absolute security. So with a cooldown, you can say that, yes, we want to update as soon as the new release is available, but let's wait 2 weeks at least. That'll let everyone else find out before I do that this has a supply chain attack, right? But that's only as good as the project. That's only as good as the community is in finding those things. And it's worked pretty well, but it's not a fail-safe. Anyways, that combined with commit SHA pinning, combined with setting that flag in your for your GitHub organization to require GitHub Actions to be pinned to a specific SHA in your workflows, I think that's a good recipe for greater security. Also, GitHub should be adding support for marketplace actions to be delivered as OCI images. And that'll also as immutable OCI images, and that's also gonna help with these issues. So a given version can't be overridden. All right, any more thoughts on this one? All right. Next announcement. Yeah, so here's a Cloud Posse announcement. That we released this a few weeks ago. I think I forgot to bring it up, so I wanted to make sure to do that on the call today. So there are a lot of modules out there for using for automating GitHub with code. We implemented our own. They have full Terra test support, so we are testing it. And we also implemented a root module, a component for managing GitHub repositories. And this is a really nice solution that overcomes the implementation problem that we've seen with most other implementations out there. So here's the deal. And it's funny because I was just speaking to a customer yesterday, and they were saying how their own in-house solution just stopped working because they're doing exactly the thing that most people do. If you create a factory inside of a Terraform root module, a factory is a pattern where you kind of have a declarative configuration. And then you iterate over all of those configs and you provision it all within a single invocation of a root module. You will at some point hit a tipping point. Just it's always when you can't afford to have it. So it's either going to be you run out of memory, it's going to be that you hit rate limits of the underlying provider, and Terraform itself gets really unhappy when it hits rate limits. And things get unpredictable. So that's what was happening in their implementation. It just stopped working because they hit some tipping point with rate limits on the GitHub API. And the only way to get around that is to split it up. Well, what if instead you took a different approach where every repository is its own state, is its own instance of the module, and that's how we do it. So in this case, this is managed with Atmos. You're looking at an Atmos configuration. Here's, for example, the repository name, whether you've enabled this configuration or not, the organization that this repository lives in, the basic repository settings, the teams, variables, secrets, etc. It supports everything available through the GitHub provider, which is pretty much everything that the underlying GitHub API supports. In our implementation, and the reason why our implementation has AWS in here, is that we are using the AWS provider to source secrets from ASM or SSM, which is convenient when you have hundreds of repositories, each with dozens of environments that need the same secret duplicated into each one of those environments or some subset of those environments. And where's the source of truth for that secret? Rather than having that be in GitHub, we are just in this solution using SSM or ASM as that source of truth. So we have some examples of the configuration here. And one of the reasons, so in this case, we're showing you kind of what how you might organize it in terms of Atmos, right? So you'd have your organization, so like your GitHub organization, let's say our GitHub organization is Cloud Posse, and then you can have a you know how you break this down is up to you because it's just Atmos stack configuration. And each one of these components is an instance of this, and it works really well with imports and inheritance. So you get dry configuration, critical for enterprise scale organizational management of GitHub. And let's see if we have an example of here using YAML anchors as well. Yeah, so and here's an example of how you can manage the amount of configuration associated with a repository these days in a sane way. So, for example, managing your environments, managing your rule sets, you can give your rule sets names like, you know, your default branch, your branch protections, and then everything required for branch protection in one file. So you don't have to have an overwhelmingly large configuration with all every possible value that you got to manage in one place. And that's what's nice, I think, really nice about our implementation is how we thought about it in a way that was very optimized when you also use a framework like Atmos. So let's see. Dan, are you here? Sorry, here a little while
Yes, I'm
ago.
here.
I thought when I was reviewing the pull request, I thought I saw an example where we were using anchors for some drying some things up.
Yeah, take a look at the app or the environment. We use that for a customer because they have over a dozen environments. But in this use case, I don't think we.
Oh,
Yeah,
here it
here's
is.
one.
Cool. Yeah. And then within, here's an example where you might have, you know, a lot of environments. I think the customer we're thinking of has like 12 or something environments. And that can also get pretty repetitive if you're defining them like this. So here's just a great example of leveraging YAML anchors to dry up that configuration within here. So define, you know, declaratively describe the attributes of a non-prod environment, do the same for prod, and then dereference that for each place you want to use it. All right. I one of the reasons I bring this up is if you've been curious about Atmos and using it somehow, but you know you have a lot of Terraform, maybe you're using other tooling, you know, switching to a new framework sounds like a big task. This could be a isolated use case for using it just to learn the power and fall in love with Atmos because after you do this, you'll learn a lot, you'll see a lot, and it's really hard to going back doing Terraform the old-fashioned way. I promise you that. All right. Any questions before we move on to the next announcement?
Yeah, just want to quickly add, I tried the factory approach that that falls over after like 50 repos or 10 users. And then when you onboard someone new or want to give them permissions with the factory approach, you're waiting like 20 minutes to make a small change. So didn't think about doing everything as an individual state file. Obviously, what you folks at Publisher is pretty slick, and still leveraging Terraform. We found a, I think you had shared a couple of other options that were like JavaScript based or webhook based. All of them fall over at scale because of rate limits
Really?
and stuff like that. And we came across one called GitHub Org Manager made by, I think, some railway
Okay.
organization in the UK. And it only does the basics like team management. And then we've been doing a factory still on the Terraform. We just kind of split it up.
Podged it
But
together. So now you don't need to do that anymore.
yeah,
And
exactly.
this should work well. And I mean, there is still, okay, so there are other considerations. So if you're running in this in GitHub Actions, we have GitHub Actions for Atmos for these things. And one of the things you can do is run it in a matrix. So every one of those repositories that's affected is planned and applied in a separate job. Each job has its own GitHub token with its own rate limits. So that gets around the rate limit issues. And then also, but then there's another limit, which is that GitHub itself matrices are limited to 250 jobs. So if you modify more than 250 jobs within a pull request, such as a global like setting inherited by every single repository, you could have a problem. We don't have the magic bullet for that right now from a GitHub Actions perspective, but that wouldn't be a limitation if you're using a forthcoming product that we have. I'm not going to waste the announcement here, but we're working on something that eliminates the problems of large batch job processing inside of GitHub and GitHub Actions through workflow dispatches.
Cool. Yeah, we are once we shifted over towards this Python app that does the team user management, that's like per organization. We have been doing the matrix job, and I didn't realize there was a limit. I thought it was a concurrency limit. I didn't realize there was a matrix limit. So it's a hard limit. It doesn't just queue it up.
You cannot have more than 250 jobs. Yeah, I believe.
So it just fails essentially, or
Yeah, but there's a workaround.
okay.
Yeah,
I'll
so
hold for the workaround. I don't have to share now, but I'll
are you familiar with the workaround?
we're only at like 20 jobs, so I can I'll let you folks solve it and just copy and paste. But
Well, we ran into this a long time ago, so we wrote a GitHub action called Matrix Extended. And basically, the idea is you do a workflow. You can have a shared workflow. You can have a workflow that calls a shared workflow, and the shared workflow can have another 250 jobs. So that gets you pretty good, but still under the limits of what enterprises have in terms of the number of repositories. So it's still a problem.
Yeah, we're still under 100 per org, but yeah, and I assume all of the everything that's repository specific is within one state file, right? That's one run. You're not doing it's not further broken out by
Yeah,
users
it's not
or
further broken out. Yeah, that was the opinionated choice that there. I think there's like a three or four or five different resources for managing a GitHub repository. We tied those into one module that is called by the root module, and it's yeah, 1-to-1 state per repository.
how have you been handling, are you guys using roles or are you guys using the admin push pull permissions for a repository?
So to in order for an app like this to work, you have to create a GitHub app in God mode.
Oh, yep. Oh, sorry. What I was referring to is when your team needs to troubleshoot something that needs admin level privileges, like org level or similar, how are you generally managing that escalation? Is it
Oh,
your job?
we don't have a solution for
Okay.
that.
Yeah, got it. Got it.
Like a just-in-time privilege escalation with expiration would be nice, but
Yeah, I haven't found anything cost effective. There's like something you get if you do an enterprise deal and I think Tenable might offer something there.
okay. I mean, they have this for like AWS, I think. Granted.
But if someone on your team needs extra access, I assume it's a manual provision and then you kind of de-escalate.
Well, so well, yeah, so we have no, I mean, in that situation, yeah, sorry, I didn't really read between the lines here. So in that situation, what we would use is Cloud Posse Sandbox, which is a different GitHub org under the enterprise where everyone gets admin access if they want it.
Got it.
So totally safe to do whatever you want and test apps out or things like this.
Okay, got it. Cool. That makes sense.
And like this GitHub action that we, or sorry, this Terraform module has automated tests, but obviously we're not testing that against Cloud Posse. We're our parent GitHub org. We have a Cloud Posse tests GitHub organization where it's the wild, wild west and anything can go on here.
Got it. So if someone needs to test a new rule set, they could basically update the Terraform for the test.